Good morning. Several of you have mentioned to me that you were looking forward to this passage today. David and Goliath, is there a more well-known story in the Bible? Maybe not. And there also might not be a more twisted and misinterpreted story in the entire Bible. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I don't know how many of you have had to endure this as being the way that you can conquer the Goliaths in your life. Apparently, I made that point too often when I first got the job at EP as the college and young adult guy. Many of you were probably there. Maybe some of you were part of this process. But a few months into my time there, the college group gave me a fraternity paddle, if you've seen those before. And in Greek, they had the words AEP, you know, Annapolis EP. That was apparently the name of the frat. And then on the back, they had engraved Goliath Slayer. So I'm aware that maybe I come down on this point too often. But that kind of thing happens so often with so many stories in the Bible that are meant to focus us on Christ. How can we make it about us? That is what we always want to do. Instead of making it about Him and what He's done for us, which moves us to be like Him. I'm well aware of how long today's passage is. I'm actually going to reserve preaching on the final verses in this chapter till next week. I'm aware that I told you last week I was going to preach on the final verses of that passage this week. I have decided, with the executive power given to me, I'm going to preach on both of those sections next week because they make more sense to deal with then. So, hear now the word of the Lord. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 1. The Philistines gathered their forces for war at Socoh and in Judah and camped between Socoh and Azekah in Ephraim. Saul and the men of Israel gathered and camped in the valley of Elah. Then they lined up in battle formation to face the Philistines. The Philistines were standing on one hill and the Israelites were standing on another hill with a ravine between them. Then a champion named Goliath from Gath came out from the Philistine camp. He was 9 feet 9 inches tall and wore a bronze helmet and bronze scale armor that weighed 125 pounds. There was bronze armor on his shins and a bronze javelin was slung between his shoulders. His spear shaft was like a weaver's beam. Think landscape timber, okay? And the iron point of his spear weighed 15 pounds. In addition, a shield bearer was walking in front of him. He stood and shouted to the Israelite battle formations, "Why do you come out to line up in battle formation?" he asked them. "Am I not a Philistine? Are you not servants of Saul? Choose one of your men and have him come down against me. If he wins in a fight against me and kills me, we will be your servants. But if I win against him and kill him, then you will be our servants and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel today. Send me a man so we can fight each other." When Saul and all Israel heard these words from the Philistine, they lost their courage and were terrified. Now David was a son of the Ephrathite from Benjamin of Judah named Jesse. Jesse had 8 sons and during Saul's reign was already an old man. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to the war, and their names were Eliab, the firstborn, Abinadab, the next, and Shammah, the third. And David was the youngest. The 3 oldest had followed Saul, but David kept going back and forth from Saul to tend to his father's flock in Bethlehem. Every morning and evening for 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand. One day, Jesse had told his son David, "Take this half bushel of roasted grain along with these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Also take these 10 portions of cheese to the field commander. Check on the well-being of your brothers and bring a confirmation from them." There was Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David got up early in the morning and left the flock with someone to keep it, loaded up, and set out as Jesse had charged him. He arrived at the perimeter of the camp as the army was marching out to its battle formation, shouting their battle cry. Israel and the Philistines lined up in battle formation facing each other. David left his supplies in the care of the quartermaster and ran to the battle line. When he arrived, he asked his brothers how they were. While he was speaking to them, suddenly the champion named Goliath, the Philistine from Gath, came forward from the Philistine battle line and shouted his usual words, which David heard. When all the Israelite men saw Goliath, they retreated from him, terrified. Previously, an Israelite man had declared, "Do you see this man who keeps coming out? He comes to defy Israel. The king will make the man who kills him very rich and will give him his daughter. The king will also make the family of that man's father exempt from paying taxes in Israel." David spoke to the men who were standing with him. "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Just who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" The troops told him about the offer, concluding, "That is what will be done for the man who kills him." David's oldest brother, Eliab, listened as he spoke to the man and became angry with him. "Why did you come down here?" he said. "Who did you leave those few sheep with in the wilderness? I know your arrogance and evil heart. You came down here to see the battle." "What have I done now?" protested David. "It was just a question." Then he turned from those beside him to others in front of him and asked about the offer. The people gave him the same answer as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, so he had David brought to him. David said to Saul, "Don't let anyone be discouraged by him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine." But Saul replied, "You can't go fight this Philistine. You're just a youth. And he's been a warrior since he was young." David answered Saul, "Your servant has been tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a lamb from the flock, I went after it, struck it down, and rescued the lamb from its mouth. If it reared up against me, I would grab it by its fur, strike it down, and kill it. Your servant has killed lions and bears. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God." Then David said, "The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." Then Saul had his own military clothes put on David. He put a bronze helmet on David's head and had him put on armor. David strapped his sword on over the military clothes and tried to walk, but he was not used to them. "I can't walk in these," David said to Saul. "I'm not used to them." So David took them off. Instead, he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the wadi and put them in his pouch in his shepherd's bag. Then, with his sling in his hand, he approached the Philistine. The Philistine came closer and closer to David with the shield bearer in front. When the Philistine looked, saw David, he despised him because he was just a youth, healthy and handsome. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you should come against me with sticks?" Then he cursed David by his gods. "Come here," the Philistine called to David, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds, the sky, and the wild beasts." And David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with a sword, a spear, and javelin. But I come against you in the name of the Lord of armies, the God of the ranks of Israel. You have defied him. Today the Lord will hand you over to me. Today I will strike you down, remove your head, give the corpses of the Philistine camp to the birds of the sky and the wild creatures of the earth. Then all the world will know that Israel has a God. And this whole assembly will know it is not by sword or by spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will hand you over to us." When the Philistines started forward to attack him, David ran quickly to the battle line to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone, slung it, and hit the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down to the ground. So David defeated the Philistine with a sling and a stone. David overpowered the Philistine and killed him without having a sword. David ran and stood over him, grabbed the Philistine's sword, pulled it from its sheath, and used it to kill him. Then he cut off his head. When the Philistines saw their hero was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah rallied, shouting their battle cry, and chased the Philistines to the entrance of the valley, to the gates of Ekron. Philistine bodies were strewn all along the Shaarim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from the pursuit of the Philistines, they plundered their camps. David took Goliath's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put Goliath's weapons in his own tent. The word of the Lord. I always hope that my emotion when I read these things does not distract from the profound meaning of the text. There is no text in the scripture, in my opinion, that more powerfully illustrates the foolishness of the gospel. This never should work. And it works so mightily, so powerfully. So kids, I need to ask you a question. So you can remember that God really loves you, kids, and that he wants you to know how you can show God that you are thankful to him, that you love him. So let me ask you a question. Would you like it if every time you played a game and if you lost the game, that people said, "You're the winner because the winner wins for you. You win." Would you like that? Not too bad, huh? No matter what happens, you win. Now, would you like it if you won, somebody else lost, and every time that happened, people said, "They win, because you won for them." Would you like that? Probably not, right? You worked really hard to win. How come they get to be told they're the winner when you won, right? That's not fair. So you kind of like it when you lose, right? But you probably wouldn't like it when you win. And they get called the winner. That's kind of what happened in the verses that we read today. Were there many brave people wanting to fight Goliath in that story? Nobody. The Bible was really clear. They ran away as soon as they saw him. Only one person was brave enough to fight. Did he think he was going to win because he was super strong? No, he said he was going to win because God was going to win for him, right? And he was right. But who got all the treasure at the end of the story? All those cowards who are hiding and afraid of Goliath. Because David won, they got to win. Is that fair? Not really. But that picture shows us a really important point. Jesus defeated sin and death. Do you have the power to do that? I'm just curious. Nope. Pastor Tom doesn't have it either. Your parents don't have it either. We all sin too much. The only reason we know we're going to go to heaven if we trust in Jesus is because he said, "I'll be good for you," because you won't be. "And my goodness will count for you. I'll take the punishment for your sin so you don't have to be the loser. You can win and go to heaven because I'm going to win for you." It's not really fair, is it? But are you glad that's the way it is? I'm glad it's the way it is. And Jesus wanted to do that for us. So what David did is a picture of what Jesus has done for us. So kids, can you thank God that he was willing to let Jesus do that for you? And when we thank God, we should thank him with what we do. So we should thank God by doing the kind things he's called us to do. Basically, to love other people like Jesus loved us, right? So can you listen to the rest of the sermon and think of ways you can thank God for having Jesus win for you? Thank you, kids, for listening. So we've been talking about how God has shown his love for Israel by giving them a shepherd king. Not a king, like the nations around them, like they wanted. Excuse me. So how does God help us have confidence in our shepherd king? Because it's natural for us to want a king like the rest of the world, right? That's what's natural for us. How does God have us have confidence in his shepherd king? First, his work will always be mocked by the wisdom of the world. So we shouldn't be surprised when that happens, right? Of course they're going to mock it, right? So that shouldn't take away our confidence. His work will always be mocked by the wisdom of the world. Second, the wisdom of the world is no match for God's foolish gospel. Obviously, foolish is in quotes. The wisdom of the world is no match for his foolish gospel. And finally, his victory in our place gives us hope. His victory in our place gives us hope. So, our first point, his work will always be mocked by the wisdom of the world. Christ said, the world hates me. So, sorry guys, if you follow me, they're going to hate you. They're going to mock you. And the idea of the foolishness of the gospel is a divinely inspired phrase that Paul uses to describe it. So we should own it. Embrace it. Be proud of it. I know this is not going to be popular. Popularity won't save me, but this gospel will. I should not be surprised when this is persecuted, rejected, mocked, whatever. And I'm still shocked. You've heard me say this before. At how often Christians are surprised, shocked, whatever else, when the world acts worldly. Can you believe Christianity was mocked by this article in this secular magazine? Not surprised one bit. Why should I be, right? Is it okay they mocked it? Of course not. But it shouldn't dismay me. If it dismays me and discourages me, then too much of my hope is wrapped up in whether I'm being approved of in these news outlets or whatever else. What my hope is in what Christ has done once and for all that the world's going to hate, but that doesn't take away my hope, then, oh yeah, see that article in Time making fun of Christianity? There they go again. My hope's not getting rocked by it. Maybe I'll write an op-ed piece that rejects the article, shows how foolish it was, maybe. But my hope can't be tied up in public opinion about Christianity. There are so many voices in this story that completely mock, disdain, or doubt David being able to be used by God. Every one of them is put to shame by the foolishness of the gospel here. So first we see his own brother, Eliab. Again, I called him Saul 2.0 last week, and he's still functioning that way. He shows not just anger at David. What are you doing down here? You know, older brother annoyed at little brother. That happens. This is beyond that. Remember what he said? Who did you leave those few sheep with in the wilderness to come down here? He doesn't just disdain David as a little brother, insignificant. What are you doing here? You're annoying me. He disdains him as a shepherd. This is no place for shepherds. This is only a place for warriors. Only might and valor will win here, and you don't have it. Get out of here. Probably also some jealousy, which we'll get to in a minute. Again, you saw Samuel's response when he saw Eliab. Surely, this is God's next choice. He's tall and good looking. That's always paid off before. Okay. So Eliab knows he was passed over for his little brother as God's choice for the next king. So we shouldn't be surprised there's some anger and jealousy mixed in with this. But again, what is he looking at? What everyone else looked at, outward appearance. Earthly things we can see, not eternal things that we have to trust. The second voice is Saul. He calls David to him, but he's not so much disdain as doubt. How could you do this? You're too young and you're too weak. There's no way God would use this. And the final one is Goliath. The cursing, hateful voice of the enemy, the powers of darkness against God's people. He's so in doubt, in shock, that this foolish thing could work. He's insulted. I wanted a real fight. You're sending me this kid with sticks? Who do you think I am? There's no way this could win. I hope we see the scene at Golgotha being reproduced here. Mocking, cursing, disdaining, doubt. What could this spectacle ever produce that's worthwhile? And it's our only hope. So each of these three views that mocked and doubt and disdain David make total sense from the perspective of the world. Who, when you look at David's son, Jesse's sons, okay, we've got eight guys here. A tall, mighty, good-looking guy who will clearly inspire loyalty. And this, the Bible goes out of its way to describe David as basically a rosy-cheeked cherub. Like, picture like Campbell's Soup Kids, all right? Like, who's passing over John Cena in favor of the Campbell's Soup Kid? Really? There's a lot of similarity in this situation between Joseph and David. God clearly is proclaiming a future, a great work he's going to do through Joseph. It is met with rejection and hatred and disdain by the brothers. They want no part of it. In fact, they'd like him dead. So Eliab is, again, in his disdain for David being a shepherd, saying, "What are you doing here? You have nothing to offer. God will not use a shepherd to fight this giant. It's all about you. You're arrogant. You're prideful. Get out of here." Saul, again, is only viewing David by outward appearance. Now, Saul shows his ineptitude as a king. He's not trusting in Yahweh. You know what? I've got confidence. Yahweh's going to win for us through this boy. Now, he tries to make David fit according to earthly schemes to fight Goliath. There are some scholars who think the reason he puts his own armor on David is that he's hoping that David is mistaken for him and he gets the credit if he wins. Like, we can't prove that. But clearly he's saying the only way you can win is if you use the weapons of the world. So let me give you the finest armor in the land. Keep in mind, if you rehearse a few chapters before, the Philistines are still controlling the iron embargo. Israel still has no swords. They're fighting with farm tools and arrows. The only swords in the land are Jonathan's and Saul's. So Saul gives David the finest sword in the land, the finest of armor, the best the world can muster up to face this enemy, and it's worthless. Because armor is not going to win, and earthly weapons won't win here. A supernatural, a divine warrior, a divine answer can win, and only that. And Goliath, his response makes total sense too, from the earthly perspective. I'm over 9.5 feet tall. I've got a spear. I mean, you don't picture a landscape timber with an 15-pound spearhead on the end. That's not something you heave like a shot put. He had a javelin on his back. That's what you throw. This is meant to be handled deftly in battle for thrusting and things like that. What's this kid got? I'm looking. No sword, no bow and arrow. He's got a stick. What do you guys think of me? This could never work. And remember, when nation went against nation, in that time, they viewed it as our gods are in combat. So your God is an absolute fool. That's why I'm cursing your God. Because there's no way he could win with this. Don't be surprised when the world has that view of your hope in Christ. Don't be discouraged by it. Instead, fall to your knees and thank the Lord that you once thought that way. You were dead in your transgressions and sin, and the Lord brought you from death to life, and now he has given you hope in Christ. and plead with the Lord to let you be an instrument in his hand to show that faith to the world, that he'll bring others, even those mocking and persecuting you, to faith. So not only should we not be shocked, of course the wisdom of the world is always going to mock this, but that wisdom of the world, is our second point, is no match for God's foolish gospel. God himself actually magnifies the foolish character of the situation and just ups the ante on how, from a worldly perspective, ridiculous the situation is. He specifically takes away from the scene anything resembling a soldier, anything resembling military power. It's all gone. The text goes out of its way to describe how David is going into battle as a shepherd and not a warrior. When the text, with very serious specificity, says, David went and found the 5 smooth stones and put them in his pouch, comma, in his shepherd's bag. Right. You don't waste words back then, okay? Writing things down is very expensive and laborious. So if it's being said and something's going out of its way to be mentioned, that is like today's all caps, underline, highlight. Not only does he go in specifically like a shepherd with a shepherd's bag, he's using a sling and stones, shepherd's tools. But he also brings his staff. Which, I mean, he saw Goliath. He sees this guy in 125 pounds of bronze armor. He's not bringing his staff because he's hoping to whack him on the head. The staff would be of absolutely no use in that situation. He's bringing his staff because it's part of his uniform. It's a way to highlight, I am coming into battle as Yahweh's shepherd. And that's the only hope God's people have. It's a way for him to say, my victory here does not depend on my skill or our military prowess. It depends on the Lord who will fight this battle for me. Israel is a picture, and Saul as their leader, of absolute faithless cowardice in this situation. And David, not a picture of bravado, a picture of faith in the one who can win for us. In verse 24, we see, when all the Israelite men saw Goliath, they retreated from him terrified. Okay. This has already been going on for 40 days. They've seen him every single day. David's now they're looking, and they still run away. There's a ravine between them. What's he going to do? That's how craven they are. David, however, in verse 26, spoke to the men who were standing with him, what will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Just who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? It's not about David. It's about doing something about the dishonor of the Lord and showing the world that Israel's God is the true God. It is faith in God's power, not faith in himself, that wins. Now, is there wisdom in Yahweh's choice here to use David? There is. Goliath is totally unprepared for shepherd's weapons. Doesn't see it coming at all. Again, a picture of Golgotha, Satan having no clue that Christ would win by giving his life. The thought is, if we take him out, we win. No idea that someone would actually offer to die for the sins of everyone. Of everyone who believes so that they could win. Not on the devil's radar at all. And by taking the road of humility and sacrifice, Christ wins for all of us. Same thing here. Scholars have said that someone skilled with a sling in this time will be able to get that stone going likely between 125 and 150 miles an hour. There's wisdom in God's choice, but it's not the wisdom of the world. So please don't let your familiarity with this story tone down the drama that's present here, because it's writ large. Goliath is still, in our day and age, the mightiest human in recorded history. Over 9.5 feet tall. I mentioned already his armor weighs probably over 125 pounds. I know some of us jog with weighted vests. I'm guessing maybe not that much, let alone what you have to do in battle. Again, I mentioned the spear shaft. Picture a landscape timber. How many of you are wrapping one hand around that and using it deftly? Don't think so. Goliath is arguably the most formidable human foe, as far as an individual, anyone's ever seen. And what's God's plan? I'm going to defeat him with a shepherd boy using shepherd's tools. Why? Because God is showing us he is superior to all earthly powers, to show us how much more is found to trust in him, even if the world rejects what he brings us. And he's more superior than anything the world can offer, whether it's what the world says will be enjoyed by following them, or when the world threatens us, if you don't come along with us, this is what's going to happen to you. God says, none of that matters. They can't give you what I'm going to give you, and they can't shut down what I am giving you in my shepherd king. So let's not be surprised at rejection, and let's not fall for when the world says they have something superior to what God gives us through our shepherd king. Nothing can compare to what he brings. So we still have yet to get to the most amazing part of this story. Yes, we know what happens. David gives the best trash talk speech in recorded history. You come at me with sword and spear, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of armies, or some text, the Lord of hosts. And today I will strike you down, and today the world will know that Israel has a God. Then he wins with shepherd's tools. But the most amazing part of the story hasn't happened yet. All the craven, cowardly losers hiding from Goliath, who all need a change of underwear, who are willing to let an unarmored boy go out and fight instead of them, walk away the victors, having plundered the enemy, put them to shame, but not because of anything they did. God's shepherd king won in their place, and his victory counts for theirs. This was not an uncommon scenario in the ancient world. Why do we have to have bloodshed all across the line? Let's just have representatives fight. Who in the right mind is going to go up against the mightiest human in recorded history? Well, if you're operating according to the wisdom of the world, nobody. But if you trust in the living God who has said, I win for my people, then nothing can stop you. There is likely some anti-Abraham activity here. Abraham, who's been told, you're going to have a son, the whole world's going to be blessed through you. I've said to you before, until that son's born, Abraham's bulletproof, right? Nothing can happen. There's trust in the word of the Lord. David knows the Lord has said, I'm going to be king over his people. He can't kill me. God can't break his word. So I'll fight in the name of the Lord, and nothing can stop his word from coming true. Trusting in the word and the promises of the Lord is the only thing that will give us hope in the face of the brokenness of ourselves, the opposition we receive from the world, and the hatred the powers of darkness have for the people of God. And it is not our ingenuity, our righteousness, our who knows what that will win. It is God fighting for us, not with wealth and power, but with his shepherd king. I said last week, why does it need to be a shepherd king? Because we need someone to deal with us. We are part of the problem. And we live in a broken world and powers of darkness that are also the problem. The shepherd deals with us. The king fights our battles for us. This story used to bother me a lot. The outcome. Why do they get... They wanted David to get killed, probably. They didn't want to do anything. They were afraid. Why did they walk away rich? Until it dawned on me that No, I'm not the potential David who's going to conquer the Goliaths in my life. I'm sitting back there with the craven cowards. But I walk away a victor because of Christ, who has defeated a foe I could never defeat. My old nature and the powers of darkness, I could never do it. But Christ's righteousness has defeated my old nature. His willingness to be sacrificed on my behalf has defeated the death sentence I was rightly under. And because of that, nothing the world can do or the powers of darkness can ever take away the hope I have in Christ. So, let us also see that it's not just that he won a victory for them, but what did his victory produce in them? He won, which means they win, and then they are empowered. Now they're brave. Now they fight. Now they do what they should have done from the beginning because they see what God has done for them through the Shepherd King. So let us, and beg the Lord, let us be emboldened by what Christ has done. We know the end of the story. We know he has defeated sin and death for us. We know nothing can take away our salvation. God will always love us like he loves Christ, even at our worst. Why would we let doubt and fear take over and complacency when we know our Shepherd King's victory means I win? So beg the Lord to help you wage war against the lies of your old nature, to bear up against the mockery and persecution you may receive from this world, and never listen to one lie of the powers of darkness. Your King has won for you, and he is also your shepherd, which means he loves you and will guide you and bring you to the end, always guaranteeing the Father's love for you, because it's based on him, not on you.